Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Todd Gitlin, a former president of Students for Democratic Society, who helped organize the first national demonstrations against the Vietnam War. Now a professor of journalism at Columbia University, he has a recent article in the New York Times, "The Left Declares Its Independence," and we will discuss the emerging Occupy Wall Street movement, both in terms of populist movements of the past and try to determine its political direction as we head towards a crucial election year. Then, on the 10th anniversary of the war in Afghanistan, we will speak with Thomas Barfield, an anthropologist who has been visiting and studying Afghanistan for 50 years. As we continue to spend $8 billion a month in a war-torn land of mud brick villages, he will provide a perspective on the American decade in a country often described as the graveyard of empires. Then finally, we will go to the ongoing demonstrations in Washington, D.C. against the war in Afghanistan and speak with one of the protest organizers, Kevin Zeese, of October2011.org, an organization which seeks to end corporatism and militarism. He served as Ralph Nader's press secretary and spokesman in 2004 and has been a political activist since graduating from George Washington Law School in 1980. Joining us now is Todd Gitlin, an American sociologist, political writer, novelist, cultural commentator, and professor of journalism and communication at Columbia University. Todd Gitlin is the former president of Students for a Democratic Society and helped organize the first national demonstrations against the Vietnam War, as well as the first civil disobedience directed against American corporate support for the apartheid regime in South Africa. He is the co-author of the new book, The Chosen Peoples, America, Israel, and the Ordeals of Divine Election, and author of Undying, a Novel. Welcome to Background Briefing, Todd Gitlin.
Thank you, Ian.
And you had a piece in the New York Times very recently, "The Left Declares Its Independence." Independent from what?
Well, I think it's a double headline. I didn't write the headline.
Sure.
I think what the piece gets at is, first of all, that there's a certain tense, though cooperative, relation between the essentially anarchist origins of the protest and the elements of organized protest who showed up in the Solidarity March on Wednesday, October 5th in New York, many thousands of people from unions and Move On and other such groups. So there's a certain degree to which these two forces are independent of each other. But I think the other meaning of the title is that the left, which is sort of held back, I think, in some ways, giving Obama the benefit of the doubt for a couple of years, is now gone off on its own, and it now poses a problem to Washington as to how to relate to this protest.
Well, I was at the Los Angeles protest on Thursday, right on the steps of City Hall, and I was actually going to talk to one of the organizers down there. But the organizers of a non-organization, and as you point out from your experiences heading up Students for Democratic Society, there are similarities, are there not, in terms of SDS had a kind of strong anarchist streak in the 1960s, and eventually, even though you were the head of it, they abolished your position because of suspicion of leadership.
Yeah, the structures of protest and activism are very different now. Because of the internet and because in some counter reaction against the hierarchical structures which were traditional, it's now possible for people in organizing affinity groups and working groups and so on, through using what they call horizontal democracy, or which is not so different from what we call participatory democracy, to organize an action. I mean, many such actions are called. Very few of them actually ignite the way this one did. But it's the principle is a horizontal organization rather than vertical organization. And, fine. I mean, obviously this sort of structure is very good at taking initiative and then inviting people in. What we don't see evidence of is that this sort of structure is capable of actually accomplishing something that keeps engaged the vast number of people who do not want to spend their time sitting in Liberty Square or Zuccotti Park or at the federal building in L.A., but, you know, are going on about their lives and want to see concrete change. They want to fight the plutocracy. How do you do that? And, you know, various there'll be disagreements about how to do it. But and I think, you know, if things work out well, then there'll be some mutual respect between, let's call them just for simplicity's sake, the anarchists and the organized, or the anarchists and the traditional, or the anarchists and the programmatic, whatever. There'll be some sort of mutual respect. If things go badly, then they'll be at each other's throats and we'll have another circular firing squad.
Well, there was certainly no evidence of that, Todd Gitlin, when I was down at City Hall on Thursday. It was actually really quite moving, I thought, and the people were just energetic and smart, committed, very grateful that somebody was actually taking them seriously. They're obviously disgusted with the snickering idiocy from mainstream journalism. I had actually a feeling, in a way, that it's a bit like the Quakers, isn't it? I mean, this is an American tradition, isn't it? At least a part of an American tradition of everybody getting their voices heard and coming to some kind of consensus. I mean, it seems to me to be, in many ways, the best hope.
Well, I mean, it's very good at some things. It's very good at galvanizing action. It's very good at rising to the occasion. It's very good at sort of what you might call paradoxically organized spontaneity. And then what is the question? And, you know, there are some people who would say, well, there is no then what. I mean, this is what they want. They're doing what they demand, which is to have this sort of life, to have a, you know, to change life, to live it communally, to live it small scale and so on. Then there'll be other people who say, well, fine. We certainly wouldn't want to convince anybody not to do that. However, we also want to see that the whole employment system doesn't go down the toilet. And in order to do that, there has to be pressure exercised via the Democratic Party because without, you know, because energy needs a motor to be effective. And just as the Tea Party became the in some ways began as, but in some ways became the, you know, the engine of the Republican Party, some sort of equivalent needs to be achieved in order to actually get results and last. You know, the plutocracy has been mounting for decades. Its strength, its ability to wrestle the resistance to the ground has been intensifying, and it, you know, the 1%, the slogan of the 1%, we are the 99%, they are the 1%. It actually makes a lot of sense. Well, you don't reverse that with a season of protest. We're talking about a long term, and you know, I think some people. By the way, it's also possible in electoral politics to have shallow ideas about how change takes place. I think there are many people, many young people in particular, who really did think that if they mobilized for Obama in 08 and elected him, then they could sort of go back to normal life. And we saw what happened when they did that. While they were going back to normal life, the Tea Party was emerging and Obama was falling short. And the upshot was that all the air was blown out of the balloon of the left. And If I think it's right that if McCain had been elected president, these protests would have taken place 2 years ago. Nonetheless, here we are, and it behooves people of varying dispositions to think about where they want to be in 6 months, where they want to be in 12 months, where they want to be in 5 years. This is a lot of damage to undo and a lot of direction to accumulate.
Again, I'm speaking with Todd Gitlin, American sociologist, political writer, novelist, cultural commentator, professor of journalism at Columbia University, and former president of Students for a Democratic Society. When you talk about employment and future employment, and maybe this movement could be a way to show us the need for a new look at employment, because shovel-ready jobs haven't worked, and the job creators that the Republicans talk about are sitting on piles of money and have no interest. They'd actually, I think, like to turn the American workforce into a third-world workforce so that they could compete with China.
Well, there are all kinds of ideas. I mean, I'm not competent to judge the merits of proposals like cancel debt or create more jobs by diminishing the number of positions, the number of full-time jobs or whatever. I mean, there are lots of ideas about that. I'm just saying that's a discussion that needs to go on. And, because I think it's amply clear from a whole variety of polls that even so-called independents are in favor of more progressive taxation, whether they want a financial transaction tax or increased progressivity in the income tax. I mean, the numbers here are quite extraordinary. There was a poll last year that discerned that 88% of those polled were either for canceling bankers' bonuses or taxing them at 50% above a certain amount. So, there's a sentiment and a passion in the direction of equity. That's great. And now it has to be focused and mobilized. It's not for any one person or any one group to decide what that program has to be. But I think that's becoming crystallized around a sort of contract with America is the way to go.
And Todd Gitlin, it's often said that the difference between anti-war protests today and back in when you were running Students for Democratic Society and organized the first national demonstration against the war in Vietnam was that the younger generation that were demonstrating actually had a stake in it, since they were likely to be drafted or had been drafted, and that the generation today doesn't have that similar stake. But that this generation, some of the students I spoke with down at City Hall the other day, do have a stake in as much as, one, they have student debts, and two, they don't have good job prospects. And and we know that the $40 billion a year for-profit school industry is the epitome of the disgusting nature of our politics in Washington, our money-driven politics. And that is a bipartisan disgrace, that both Democrats and Republicans have been bribed by these for-profit schools. They just simply take Congress ladles out taxpayer money to these diploma mills, who then charge these students back tons of at huge interest rates and give them an absolutely worthless education, and then it'll saddle them with these huge debts.
Sure.
So is there a possibility that that will be the galvanizing factor?
I don't think there should be. I mean, I would think it would be unlikely there'd be a single galvanizing. I mean, we have galvanization. Galvanization has taken place. Now the question is, where should the energy for actual campaigning, lobbying, civil disobedience, and other forms of action be? What's the focus? That certainly sounds like a plausible focus to me. I mean, maybe there should be 5 points or something, and let people work on different elements of a program. But I do think there should be coalescence around a program.
Well, I was going to suggest, though, that the conclusion that one has to come to is that we have a money-driven political system.
Well, that's an irresistible conclusion.
Right, and that this is a bipartisan disaster. So when you talk about the left somehow both propelling the Democratic Party to get honest in this coming election year, I didn't get any sense of that they were interested in either supporting the Democrats and certainly not the Republicans. So
you mean in the crowd in L.A.?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that may well be. And, it, you know, it may well be that a lot of the people who are sitting in Zuccotti Park in New York feel the same way. Nevertheless, you know, this movement is much larger than the people who are occupying the park. I mean, there are a few hundred people in the park in New York anyway the other day. I mean, I was there all day Wednesday. In the morning, there were never more than, I would say, maybe at the outside, 250 people in the park until the parade began, the march. But when the march began, which included people from the nurses' union, teachers' union, various other unions, mostly retail workers and others like that, plus Move On, plus other sort of professional groups, plus student groups, there were eventually, I don't know, somewhere between 10 and 15,000 people there. So most of those 10 to 15,000 people are not people who want to create a new society in the park. They're people who want to win some results and get jobs. So I'm here addressing those people who are, I think, the very large majority of the supporters. But I mean no disrespect to the people in the park or the people who are occupying any other places. I think they've done wonderful work. And if they feel passionately that it ill behooves them to sort of diminish their demands to something achievable, God bless them. And, you know, let them do their thing, too.
Well, as you say in your article in the New York Times, this is a movement busy being born,
right,
to quote Bob Dylan. I don't see it heading in the way, at least I hope it doesn't head in the way that you talked about in your article about SDS, you know, the quarreling between the Maoist, Guevarist, and the Stalinist factions. It seems, even though, you know, there is the obvious balkanization on the left that's manifest in most demonstrations.
Well, balkanization and, you know, conflict, tension over approaches goes with the territory. This is a big country, very diverse. There are going to be different interests. There are going to be different spirits, different passions, different ideological tempers, different cultures. It's fine. As long as this movement remains nonviolent, then coexistence is possible and could very well be fruitful.
But
The danger is people who think, you know, that this is time for a revolutionary seizure of power, and then they blow it for everybody.
Well, but I think the idea that we are the 99%, that's a pretty broad tent, right? 99% of the country.
Yeah, well, right. And, you know, it's going to be conducive to all kinds of, you know, under the big top, there are many acts.
Well, I must say that for the first time in some time, I feel at least there's something, an alternative to continuing despair, which...
I'll tell you, Ian, there were many charming and moving picket signs, placards in the march on Wednesday, and one of my favorites was a woman who had written out simply, "This is the first day I've felt hopeful in a long time."
Well, Todd Gitlin, I thank you for joining us here today.
You're very welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Todd Gitlin, who's an American sociologist, political writer, novelist, cultural commentator, and professor of journalism and communication at Columbia University. He's the former president of Students for a Democratic Society and helped organize the first national demonstration against the Vietnam War, as well as the first civil disobedience directed against American corporate support for the apartheid regime in South Africa. He's the co-author of the new book, The Chosen Peoples, America, Israel, and the Ordeals of Divine Election, and author of Undying, a Novel. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with anthropologist who has visited and studied Afghanistan for decades.
a parting of the flies from the shadow of an empire. God loves a trier, an articulate liar. The auctioneer makes it clear and boom.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Thomas Barfield, who is a professor of anthropology at Boston University, where he directs the Institute for the Study of Muslim Societies and Civilizations. He's also president of the American Institute of Afghanistan Studies and the author of Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Barfield.
Thank you very much.
And on this 10th anniversary of the U.S. war in Afghanistan, Thomas Barfield, since you have been visiting and studying Afghanistan for many decades, since the 1970s, I'd like to get a sense, as we continue to spend $8 billion a month in this war-torn land of mud brick villages, I wanted to sort of get your perspective on the American decade in a country often described as the graveyard of empires.
Well, two things. What I would say is that the United States went in probably too optimistically about the degree of peace it established at the end of 2001 and the degree to which it could transform Afghanistan. At the same time, at the end of 10 years, I think both frustration and for the first time spending much attention looking at the problems of Afghanistan has actually made people, far more negative about it. The truth probably lies somewhere in between. We attempted to do too much. We lost many, many opportunities. But at the same time, we really haven't stepped back and said, okay, what do we really want? And more importantly, what do the Afghans really want that might lead to a stable future?
Well, but at this point, and I think a lot of people have suggested that this has been a subtext, if you will, if not, front and center for since it began, is the extent to which it's a surrogate war between India and Pakistan. Now that, of course, Afghan's leader was recently in India making a strategic alliance of some kind, the first such alliance that the countries has in fact made. How much has this 10-year decade been a history of the United States going one direction and its supposed ally Pakistan undermining it at every step?
Well, I think that started from day one, when Pakistan said that it would handle its side of the border and make sure bin Laden and al-Qaeda did not escape from Afghanistan, that they would handle their half. When it turned out, they allowed that border to be porous so that bin Laden and many of his cohorts escaped from Tora Bora. But more importantly, they decided that they would side with us in trying to suppress al-Qaeda to a certain degree, but they never really dropped their support of the Taliban. On the other hand, I do not think, at least until recently, it's really been a surrogate conflict between India and Pakistan. I think that's Pakistan's mentality. I don't think until recently it's been on India's radar whatsoever.
But there are indications that India sees a strategic vacuum as the U.S. and NATO pull out in 2014.
As I was saying, until recently, I didn't think that was true. But in fact, when it looked like Afghanistan was going to remain unstable, that Pakistan was continuing its disruptive policies, and that the United States and its Western allies were about to leave, I think that did focus India's attention, because they are the regional power in the area, and they are the ones that most directly feel the brunt of jihadist groups, both in Kashmir and attacking India itself. To see that as a situation that they would find strategically destabilizing. So I believe over the past few years that, it has moved much more in that direction. But I don't believe it originally started out that way.
Well, Thomas Barfield, just dealing with the present, where these remarks by the Chairman of Joint Chiefs obviously were pointed and very blunt. And my understanding is that that Admiral Mullen was feeling pressure from the junior officer corps in Afghanistan, who are fed up with, in effect, being shot in the back, you know, either by Pakistan or by you know, across that border where the, essentially it's a haven or a refuge, a sanctuary from which all these attacks are being launched, or most of these attacks are being launched. And after all, the Quetta Shura is in Quetta, which is in Afghanistan. So is it now, is there anything to be gained from this kind of honesty? Because it seems to me that deluding ourselves isn't particularly helpful.
I think it's a refreshing step in the right direction. This has been well known for most of the decade that this has occurred. And it's not just the junior officers that have complained about this. It's the senior officers as well. But for political reasons, particularly when the Bush administration named Pakistan a major non-NATO ally, allowing them to receive more advanced weapons, even though that they'd really not held up their side of the bargain, until the Obama administration, and I'd say really almost until, you know, the past year, and particularly with the death of bin Laden, the whole contradiction in this policy had by both sides been buried. And because there wasn't so much American attention on Afghanistan or the Pakistan relationship, the question of how can you have an ally that's supporting your enemy, it's a contradiction in terms, that has now entered the American political debate, which it really hadn't before. So we're seeing something that was well known, but it's now moved to a policy a level. And also, until recently, Pakistan has been able to control the terms of debate that maybe there's some problems, but they really are our allies. And I think these protestations, particularly when bin Laden was discovered, you know, near Pakistan's West Point, this had been ringing hollow in the region, and particularly Afghanistan, for a very long time. It now rings hollow in the United States as well.
Again, I'm speaking to Thomas Barfield, a professor of anthropology at Boston University, where he directs the Institute for the Study of Muslim Societies and Civilizations. He's also the president of the American Institute for Afghanistan Studies and author of Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History. So, Thomas Barfield, I'm sort of hear contradictory things from people that are either specialists on Afghanistan and Pakistan and political activists as well. The political activists are suggesting that, and this is being reflected in the press in Pakistan, that the upping of the ante in terms of Admiral Mullen's rhetoric, et cetera, and the increased use of drones is an indication that the U.S. is likely to cross the border in hot pursuit and change the rules, you know, going back to the Vietnam War with the bombing Cambodia, that analogy. That's one scenario. I find that highly unlikely. I mean, the U.S. military must understand that's a hornet's nest across the border there, and it's, you know, there's nothing they can do about it, essentially, right?
I believe they're loath to get involved in attempting to move into Pakistan's northwest frontier province. It presents a problem as that Pakistan declares its sovereignty over a part of the country that it actually has no control over. This is also one of the contradictions that people really don't understand, is that even when Pakistan came into existence as a nature, the Fatah, the federally administered tribal area, always was outside of direct government control. The British had left it that way. So you had this ungoverned territory up against an international border. And that's always been problematic. That's been problematic ever since they drew the border. But that has been recognized. I think probably the greater pressure is on Pakistan to do something about the Quetta Shura. Baluchistan, where Quetta is located, is an area where Pakistan does control. And so I think if there's any sort of quid pro quo in terms of what the United States is looking for, it may have as much to do with the so-called Quetta Shura, Mullah Omar and his people, than it does with the so-called Haqqani network, the people that straddle the border in the tribal districts.
But Thomas Barfield, if my understanding is that the president doesn't want to escalate this war, he actually wants to get the hell out. They need the money that's being wasted there, billions and billions, as I mentioned. I believe it's $8 billion a month, $150 million a week or something. That seems to be pretty clear that they want out. I don't even know that the American Empire types in the military have much traction here. So where does it stand if we pull out? Obviously, Pakistan's going to try and fill the vacuum through their Taliban surrogates, and that seems to be what they've been doing all along, is just sort of keeping their powder dry or keeping their foot in the door, if you will. What about this talk of we need to keep Pakistan stable and keep our relationship going because of the possibility of loose nukes, et cetera? Where do all those scenarios stand in your mind?
Well, in my mind, we need to separate out the Afghanistan problem from the Pakistan problem, that Pakistan and the possibility that it could split or that the government could lose control to its own insurgents is a separate question from Afghanistan. And the question that comes up is that the Taliban took over essentially because there was a vacuum in the 1990s that no country was interested in Afghanistan. That made it very easy for neighbors to support surrogates at a very small scale and have a great impact. It's not clear that the United States, even with it withdraws its troops, is going to withdraw completely. It could still leave 25 or 30,000 troops on the ground. The Soviets withdrew every last person, closed every last base, and left. The United States seems to be talking about leaving about 20, 25,000 troops. If that is the case, I don't think the Taliban would have the ability to take over the government. They need an absolute withdrawal of international troops to be able to take over the government. And even then, I am not sure, since that would provoke a civil war, that they're in a position to win a second civil war in Afghanistan, since the non-Pashtuns who formerly formed the Northern Alliance would seek out international allies in order to prevent that. It would be very, very bad for Afghanistan, but it's no slam dunk that that Pakistan supported the Taliban would be as successful as it was in the 1990s.
And what about Pakistan's flirtation with China, the idea that it could replace the U.S. With China as its guarantor or financial guarantor?
I consider that to be, again, a Pakistani misreading of the international situation. Pakistan has provided nuclear technology to Pakistan. It's provided missile technology. It's certainly built a number of infrastructure projects, but has never given Pakistan money. The United States has given billions of dollars to the Pakistanis, particularly the Pakistani military. It's dependent upon that. It is by no means clear that the Pakistanis can rely on the Chinese to replace any of that cash flow. The Chinese seem to have a remarkably tight purse when it comes to giving out money. Second, the Chinese just closed down a $19 billion agreement in, I believe, the Sindh project, a mining project, because they declared that Pakistan was too unstable. That doesn't sound like an all-weather ally. But I think the most important thing is that China, in its western part of its country, in Xinjiang, is concerned, perhaps overly concerned, perhaps even obsessive, about a Uyghur resistance movement. And the Uyghurs are an Islamic Turkish group in western China, some of whom were training in Pakistani camps with al-Qaeda. I find it hard to believe that the Chinese would be keen on allowing the Pakistanis to support Islamist groups when they perceive a threat to their own western part of the country from these same Islamist groups.
But I've also heard, Thomas Barfield, the critique that while we are spending $8 billion a month on a country, war-torn country of mud brick villages, the Chinese are investing in new technology. And the irony is, of course, that the Chinese have a copper mine in Afghanistan, which the U.S. military protects, I believe. And there many people think that the American Empire is out for resources, and that's why we fight these wars. And it's not clear to my mind that the cost of Iraq is going to be yielded in Iraqi oil. And it's certainly not clear to my mind the cost of Afghanistan is going to be yielded in American control of minerals and stuff. If you know, it doesn't seem like the U.S. is in there at all. The Chinese seem to be.
I certainly agree with you on that. Afghanistan has plenty of mineral wealth. The great irony is we seem to be stabilizing Afghanistan so that the Indians and Chinese can develop it. But I believe that's another reason why the Chinese are not too keen to see instability in Afghanistan, because that copper mine has just begun. It's not yet productive. And in order to make it productive, the Chinese would have to build a railway across Afghanistan to bring the minerals out. it needs a stable Afghanistan to make its investments pay off. So the Chinese have a strong interest in seeing a stable Afghanistan, just from a purely economic point of view. And so for that reason, I think that the mineral resources, the potential hydroelectric power that could flow from Central Asia to Pakistan. There have been riots in Pakistan recently about the lack of electricity. Pakistan's most obvious supply of that comes from ex-Soviet hydro plants. All of that requires a stable Afghanistan in order to allow the region to develop economically. So with the exception of Pakistan, I would say that every country in the region sees the desirability of coming to some kind of conclusion in Afghanistan that allows to become a normal country where investments can take place.
So if the U.S., China, India, Iran, and Russia, all the neighbors with a stake in a stable Afghanistan in the future, if they want stability, what can they do that's going to somehow convince Pakistan to accept whatever follows? Because what we continually hear is that this we could go back to a civil war, if not a surrogate war.
Yes, I think one of the things that India might do is simply say that if you do not want to see India directly involved in Afghanistan and taking the United States' place in Afghanistan, then cut a deal now. Because India, with far less troops, could decide it wants to take a training and support role of the Afghan government. And it has built a road from the Persian Gulf to the borders of Afghanistan. It could supply those troops without having to go into through Pakistan. India has no desire to put in troops or get involved in a war in Pakistan. But if it's a question of a political vacuum, a military vacuum, they could find themselves drawn in. Now, one way to use that positively is to say that is Pakistan's worst strategic nightmare. So why don't we negotiate a settlement so it doesn't come to that?
Well, Iran would have to agree with that, though, wouldn't it?
Yes, but Iran is a strong ally of India. It would love to see America out and India in. It helped facilitate India building that road across Iran.
So what about the dealing with Pakistan from the Indian perspective or from any of the regional players' perspective? The problem there is surely that there are two governments. There's a weak civilian government and a perennial military government.
That's why when we're talking about convincing the military, you believe if the international troops pull out that you have a Taliban victory, the Taliban are your surrogates. There's two problems with that. Number one, Afghans tend to be nobody's surrogates. The Taliban did not follow Pakistani advice in 2001 when they said, get rid of bin Laden, otherwise the Americans will come. The Taliban ignored that. Many Taliban are highly nationalistic. They may be working for Pakistan now, but if they were in power, it's not clear. They would feel themselves beholden. The second thing is that precisely because the Pakistani military is so paranoid about India, to say, well, this could happen, and particularly if the neighbors thought that would bring about stability, that might make more sense in terms of forcing a change in policy if the military thought, you know, this is essentially, you know, one of those checkmate kind of moves that we want to avoid. But I would say if every country in the region wants to see stability and Pakistan doesn't, it potentially moves itself into becoming a South Asian North Korea when its neighbors have to figure out how do we control a state that seems to be acting from the point of view of its neighbors irrationally and dangerously.
Well, Thomas Barfield, I thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Thomas Barfield, who's a professor of anthropology at Boston University, where he directs the Institute for the Study of Muslim Societies and Civilizations. He's also the president of the American Institute for Afghanistan Studies and the author of Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with Kevin Zeese, who's one of the organizers of the ongoing demonstrations against the Afghanistan war in Washington, D.C. Musalmana bachi dilma kashan Musalmana bachi dilma kashan Nami donam vatanochi abala
right if everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and joining me now is Kevin Zeese, who is the co-director of It's Our Economy. He's the director of Come Home America and serves on the steering committees of the Bradley Manning Support Network and October2011.org. He's been active in third-party electoral politics and served as Ralph Nader's press secretary and spokesman in 2004. He ran for Maryland's U.S. Senate seat on the Green Party ticket in 2006 and was the only person ever nominated by the Green Party, the Libertarian Party, and the Populist Party. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kevin Zeese.
Good to be on with you. Thanks for having me.
And, Kevin, give us an update on today's activities. Of course, Friday being the 10th anniversary of the war in Afghanistan in Washington, D.C. It seems like there's a number of protests. There were protests against the IMF and also at the Smithsonian against an exhibit of drones. Give us a sense of what's going on in the city.
Well, this is all part of the Occupy movement that's kind of swept the country since Occupy Wall Street. We have a project called Stop the Machine, Create a New World. We have a Facebook page with that name, and also if you look at the October2011.org site, you can see a lot about it. But we started this on October 6th, which was the beginning of the 11th year of the Afghanistan war. And it's also the first week of the new federal budget, which provides for austerity budgets for everything except for war. So everything else gets cut back while war moves forward. And so what we have in Washington, D.C. on Freedom Plaza is an occupation. It's kind of like Tahrir Square on a small scale, and in Spain where they do something similar, in Madison, Wisconsin, where people are taking over a public space, and there's all sorts of messages about the economy's injustice as well as the need to cut the military budget and end these wars. And so we had an event yesterday where we went to a Smithsonian museum that has a kind of glorifies weapons of mass destruction from Hiroshima and Nagasaki to the drones that are currently killing us and civilians every day, that the U.S. is sending to Pakistan and other countries. And so people went in to do a die-in, and were met at the door by security guards who pepper sprayed them and pushed them out and closed the museum. So it was quite a reaction from them. So this is just one of many things going on to protest the wars, but also to protest economic injustice in this country.
And Kevin Zeese, in terms of economic injustice, the rallying cry, we are the 99%, drawing attention to the 1% who increasingly control America, which is rapidly becoming a kind of corporate plutonomy, and it's the power of money versus the power of people, and money seems to be in the driver's seat at the moment. And there you have right there in Washington, ground zero of money, which is K Street, where all the lobbyists are. Is there any sense that will be a target? Because that seems to be the 99% in many ways seem to be the most effective glue for these disparate movements.
No question. I think economic insecurity is much like the draft was in Vietnam. It makes it personal. Economic insecurity really affects every American except for the top 1%. Our first day's action actually on Thursday the 6th was to go to the Chamber of Commerce, which is probably the corporate bully of Washington, D.C. It's not the Chamber of Commerce in your local area, but the U.S. Chamber of Commerce that represents transnational corporations and takes a lot of foreign money and funnels it into lobbying in the United States to protect transnational interests. We are definitely targeting K Street. There's also another occupation going on, Occupy D.C., which is on 15th and K at McPherson Plaza. That started October 1st as part of the Occupy movement. If you want to see how big the Occupy movement is, OccupyTogether.org lists hundreds of occupations that are planned or already going on throughout the United States. This is like taking over from everywhere. And I think that's because it's such a widespread problem. You mentioned the economic disparity. Well, you have 400 people in this country with wealth equal to 154 million people. That's disparity. You have 1% with the wealth of 95%. That's feudal ages type of an economy. In fact, in the feudal ages, the wealthiest 2% had the wealth equal to 90%, so we're actually worse than the feudal ages. You have a president who's fundraising for a $1 billion campaign, and he's holding fundraisers that cost $38,500 to get into. That's more than the median income of an individual in the United States. So if you earn the individual median income, you could not afford to go to an Obama fundraiser, even if you used all your money from the year. So the government's out of touch with the people on this issue. In fact, it's listening to those with lots of money. If you look at our website, October2011.org, you can see seven issues where super majorities of Americans, you know, 60% or more, agree on a solution to a various problem, and the government's going in the opposite direction. We're with the 60%. We're with the super majority of Americans, and I think our views are more mainstream than what the government's putting in place.
And Kevin Z, since you've been organizing these protests, and you mentioned the security guards at the Smithsonian using pepper spray, I believe there was an interloper from the right-wing American Spectator who had infiltrated the movement. He also got pepper sprayed. But what is the general tenor of Washington, D.C.'s police because there's an awful lot of different police jurisdictions in Washington. How are they handling things as opposed to NYPD? As you know, they've been pretty tough on the demonstrators in New York, and there's been some arbitrary police abuse.
And behavior. That's right. I mean, actually, in Washington, D.C., the police have been quite good, I must say. I think they've made a decision, maybe learning from New York, that being abusive actually draws more attention and more support for the protests. We have on our website, you can see, we're training people in nonviolence. These are nonviolent protests. This one instigator that snuck in, pretended to be with us, actually was there to try to escalate to a violent protest. And that's not where we wanted to go, but he went and took it that direction. And so it's disappointing to see that kind of behavior happening. We do know the police, of course, are infiltrating as well to monitor what we're doing. But so far they're not instigating any kind of violence. We've seen that kind of thing in other parts of the country and world where police get into a crowd, pretend to be part of it, and then actually create violence. That has not happened here. The D.C. police have actually been very responsible so far, very cooperative. Tonight's a key night for us. So any people who know anyone in Washington, D.C., tell them to come down and join us. We're going to have a big dance party tonight because at 10 o'clock we expect that we'll be asked to leave and we're going to stay and really occupy this plaza. We have a permit till tonight. We've been doing things that violate the permit, no doubt, having tents and sleeping and some of our food preparation violates the permit, so we're already in violation. But tonight the permit runs out at 10 o'clock. We plan to have an all-night dance party. So anyone who knows anyone in the D.C. area, send them down to Freedom Plaza on 13th in Pennsylvania to join us for an all-night dance party and help us to hold the plaza for this democracy space.
Again, I'm speaking with attorney and activist Kevin Zeese, who's the co-director of It's Our Economy, director of Come Home America. He serves on the steering committees of the Bradley Manning Support Network and October2011.org. He's in Washington, D.C. Tell me what's going to happen in the following days, not to mention tonight, where you are going to overstay your welcome. Is it Liberty Plaza you're calling it?
Freedom Plaza.
My guess is
we've actually, I think, are kind of winning the war. I mean, the incredible press we've been getting, very positive media attention, even from corporate media. One article in the Post the other day, the reporter talked about how she was coming over to the plaza and talking to cab drivers, and everyone she talked to was supportive of our message, because I think every American feels this. We really are the 99%. The anger, even through the Tea Party, is about economic injustice and economic insecurity. They have different solutions than we do, but they're also suffering in an unfair economy, and I think people all feel this. They see the bailouts of Wall Street, not just the program from the Treasury Department, but also the Federal Reserve giving. In fact, the Treasury Reserve gave loans that are bigger than our GDP to the banking system. So they are pretty aggressively giving money at low cost to banks, and banks are taking big bonuses and big salaries, have big profits, not paying taxes, and not investing back in the economy. So people are, for good reason, very angry. The foreclosure crisis continuing. We're probably halfway through it at this point. We have many houses that are valued at less than their mortgage. They're underwater. And looking at where it's going, there are a lot more foreclosures coming. It could be stopped, but the government's not taking action to stop them. They could have their their mortgage shrunk to the size of the value of the home, and not the housing bubble price, but the government's not doing that either. So lots of inadequate action by the government, lots of anger on the people, and I think for very good reason they're getting out in the streets, because the electoral system and the government system of lobbying is dysfunctional. Only the money talks, and the people are ignored. We want to shift power to the people away from concentrated corporate wealth, and really see this democracy become a participatory democracy, not a corporate oligarchy.
And Kevin Z, since you've been a political activist since graduating from George Washington Law School in 1980, that's three decades of activism. Give us a sense of how you see the rank and file. I was on Thursday down here at Occupy LA demonstrations, right on the steps of City Hall, and spoke to a cross section of the people that were encamping down there. The younger students, I thought, were quite powerful in the message that, you know, that they're laden with corporate debt, with the student debt, but also corporate debt, in as much as teenagers, they're encouraged to get credit cards, etc. And you know, I just wondering about the glue for a new movement. We started out the hour today, Kevin, with Todd Gitlin, who ran the Students for Democratic Society in the Vietnam War and organized the first national demonstration against the war of Vietnam, to get a kind of sense of what happened then, and as opposed to what's happening now. So, give me your description of the elements of this movement, and perhaps what is going to build it into a
lot of the energy comes from youth, which is great. It's really great to see young late teenagers and 20-year-olds getting active. And I think student debt, this generation has the highest level of student debt ever. We're approaching $1 billion in student debt, and it's kind of another bubble that's about to burst, because these kids are leaving school with, you know, $500 to $1,000 a month payments on their student debt, and they're have the worst job prospects of any generation in my memory. So they're in a bad state of affairs. But and I think that economic insecurity is really pulling people out. I mean, the war happens to be the anniversary of the war, and people recognize that military spending is 55% of federal discretionary spending, and that the war budgets keep going up while everything else is held back. So they all see that, and that, I think, adds the anger about the war. And they can't imagine what 11th year of war will do that didn't in the last 10, so why are we still there? But the energy, I think, is really coming from economic insecurity, a lot from youth, but also a lot from people who are being knocked out of the middle class. We have on our page stories from people, why I'm coming to Washington, D.C., and the stories are powerful. You know, middle-class people who've lost jobs, lost homes, and find themselves living in cars, families that have lost children because they don't have adequate health insurance and can't get adequate health care. I mean, the reality is 100,000 people in this country die each year from preventable illnesses. And many people have insurance but still can't afford to go to the doctor. It's a very sad situation where we are, and, of course, unemployment's so high. So it's the economic insecurity that's driving it, and people have a sense of unfairness and injustice when they see that these 400 wealthiest people, who have as much wealth as 154 million of us, pay about 17% in federal taxes, while the middle class pays 25 to 30% in federal taxes. It just doesn't make much sense. These folks should be paying much more than the middle class is, not equal to, but much more from the progressive tax system. They should be paying much more in taxes than they are.
Well, just in closing, Kevin Zies, there was a recent report from the Pew Research Center that one-third of the veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan believe that the wars were a mistake and weren't worth it. And a lot of these veterans come home and get these worthless diplomas from these for-profit colleges, which leverage tax dollars, which the Congress gives them for next to nothing, and then they can charge them back and saddle these kids with student debt. So the veterans are getting screwed as well, in the same way that the students are. So there should be a kind of as opposed to the Vietnam War days, where some of the demonstrations were hostile towards the soldiers, there should be some empathy and solidarity there, surely.
No question. We have lots of vets here. In fact, on the first day, we had a beautiful march of vets coming into the plaza. They came in formation and circled the plaza, and we were all surrounded by vets, and people were very excited to see that. They were followed, by the way, about 15 minutes later by a delegation from Madison, Wisconsin, you know, which a lot of us got this inspiration from seeing what happened in Madison in the early part of that rebellion. We've really been encouraged, and I just today was with a bunch of Egyptians and Tunisians who were at the plaza, who were involved in those revolts. And so this is something happening around the world and throughout the country, affecting lots of people. This concentrated corporate capitalism, this neoliberalism, has a dramatic effect on the United States, but also has a dramatic effect around the world. And I think people are really waking up at the same time, the same circumstances, and want to see not just tinkering change, but radical change, transformational change,
right,
away from government by the corporation, government by the people.
I thank you so much for joining us there, Kevin Zeese.
Thank you very much.
Again, Kevin is the co-director of It's Our Economy, director of Come Home America, serves on the steering committees of the Bradley Manning Support Network and October2011.org. He's been active in third-party politics, served as Ralph Nader's press secretary and spokesman in 2004, and what did we learn on Background Briefing today? We began with Todd Gitlin, who was able to give us a fairly long perspective on demonstrations and populist political movements in this country, given that he organized the first national demonstration against the Vietnam War, and he was head of Students for a Democratic Society. He's been down in Zuccotti Park and spent time with the demonstrators there, and is actually fairly optimistic that this could be the, we are the 99%, it could be the glue of a new political movement that could sweep the country and not necessarily fall victim to the balkanization of politics on the left, which tends to diffuse these movements. And of course, back in the 60s, the SDS were so non-hierarchical that they finally got rid of their president and vice president, of course, being Gitlin himself. But in general, there was a real sense of optimism. We spent the rest of the program talking about Afghanistan on the 10th anniversary with an anthropologist who'd been studying and visiting the country for 50 years. I chose him because I think he knows more than most people about the country. Clearly, he thinks that calling it as it is, in terms of the relationship between the United States and Pakistan, who essentially want the Taliban to win and want to control the place once the U.S. pulls out, he basically felt that now that the cards are on the table, actually it was a healthier situation, but he felt that India is going to move in to fill the vacuum, and that could create enormous problems. But if all of the neighborhood get together and pressure Pakistan into wanting to stabilize the place, maybe there's some hope. And then finally, we spoke with Kevin Zeese of the October 2011 movement, got an update on where the demonstrations are in Washington, D.C. And again, very, very hopeful signs that maybe the 99% can take back this country from the 1%. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. And this program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. I'll be back again tomorrow from 5 to 6 p.m. Monday through Thursdays here at KPFK with Background Briefing. Bye for now.